Good morning, and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. I call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. The time is 9:03. And with me today is Senator Meyer, Senator Gardner, welcome, Senator Hughes, and Senator Stevens. And I'm Senator Mia Costello. Today we will be hearing from the chief researcher at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, who's here with us today, Dan Robinson. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
Dan provided slides in advance of the meeting, and so I hope that committee members get a chance either later today or during the committee or had a chance already to look through those. So I appreciate you getting that to us. So I'd especially like to welcome to the committee today our new members. Senator Shelley Hughes is the vice chair. Welcome, Senator Hughes.
Thank you.
I know you have a long history of being interested in issues of economic development, so I certainly welcome your contributions to the committee and appreciate you being willing to be vice chair. We also today, this morning, are welcoming Senator Gardner, who's new to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And again, I'm excited to have you on board also and look forward to working with you in the committee. That's wonderful. Also, we have returning members, our former Senate President and current Rules Chair, Senator Kevin Meyer. Welcome.
Thank you.
And our resident history professor, Senator Stevens, and certainly welcome you in the committee, and your contributions that you've provided have been so valuable, and we hope to have a continued involvement from you. So the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is truly the legislature's committee on the economy. Our committee has a wide range of responsibilities, from energy and job training to health insurance, infrastructure, consumer protection, and technology. The work that we do touches the lives of all Alaskans. We're getting right to work this session, beginning our committee with 2 weeks of hearings on the condition of the state's economy. And the economy is surely a topic that is on the minds of all Alaskans as we start this session. Our state faces serious challenges. The Alaska Department of Workforce Development, whose commissioner just joined us, welcome Commissioner Dragas, estimates that our state lost 6,800 jobs last year and forecast additional declines this year. We're seeing this not only in the data, but in our neighborhoods and from our neighbors. We see small businesses closing. Our neighbors are putting their homes up for sale and moving. Sometimes our children come home from school and they say that one of their classmates is no longer there because they have moved. In the midst of this, our economy, there are also bright spots worth highlighting. We've seen growth industries like healthcare and tourism, and certainly Dan is going to be reviewing some of those bright spots today. Companies like Alaska Airlines, Odom, and others are investing tens of millions of dollars in new facilities and hotels in Alaska, in Anchorage. The stationing of F-35 fighter jets in Fairbanks will bring over $500 million in military spending to our state. Recent new discoveries of new oil on the North Slope demonstrate the future potential of Alaska's resource base. Despite these positive indicators, however, we still have a lot of work to do to grow our economy. During the next 2 weeks, we'll hear from policy experts, industry, and communities to help us sort through the data, the trends, and the policy options available to us as legislators. I invite all Alaskans and all legislators to join us as we better understand the changes we're seeing and how we can move Alaska's economy forward. And I would also like to announce that the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee has a Facebook page. And if you're listening or in the audience today, I welcome you to open up your Facebook app and search for us and like us, because this is going to be a way for the committee to easily communicate with our constituents and the Alaska public on the hearings and the bills that we will have before the committee. And when I spoke, Dan, with you earlier today, you had suggested you were open to questions, and so I will throw that out there. If there are questions that individuals would like to send to our Facebook page, we will certainly forward those on to you.
Absolutely.
And appreciate your offer to be so involved in helping Alaskans understand our economy. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Dan Robinson, again, the research chief for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Senator. Just a quick note on who we are, for those who don't know, and with a special emphasis on what we do. We and others like us in other states produce employment, wage, unemployment rate, population numbers. So that gives us, it's a meat and potatoes job, but that gives us a unique perspective on the numbers. We have an idea how strong they are, how precise they are, when conclusions should be drawn from them, and when they shouldn't. Others in the state have a little bit more of a sophisticated role with modeling or other things, but we're kind of like the meteorologist who tells you what the weather is, and we try to do it as absolutely straightly as we can, whether it's a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent in the governor's office. Those things don't change with the data.
And Dan, I did want to mention, just so that, because I'm sure the members are wondering if we're taking questions throughout your presentation or if we're going to wait until you're over. So what I'm going to do is give you a chance to go through your presentation, and then members, we do have floor at 11. However, if you do have questions afterwards, we'll take them then. And also, Dan will be returning to the committee with all of the presenters in a panel format, so questions will be most welcome also at that time. So you have plenty of opportunity, but first we'll just let him power through his data and research.
Thank you. So jumping to the first slide, so this is the basic look of our economy right now, with the emphasis on 2016. That number is not final, but it's close to final. So we lost 2% of our jobs. It's about 6,800 in 2016. That's the most job loss we've seen in a single year since the 80s. It's not nearly as much as we lost in the 80s, as we'll talk about in a minute. But 2017, we are forecasting a loss in that same range. Another thing to point out here is that the growth headed into the current period wasn't particularly strong. That's fairly modest growth. And one more thing to notice on this slide is that 0.4% in 2009, that was during the U.S. Great Recession. And that was mild compared to other states. We did not see the kind of job loss or other economic distress that most other states did. Jumping to the next slide, here are some details on 2016's numbers. Oil and gas, 2,800 jobs. That's a 20% decline, very large. And keep in mind, those jobs pay an average of $120,000 a year, so $3.5 billion, roughly. Some other high-wage professional and business services sector, that's among other things, the geologists, the engineers, directly tied to oil and gas and to the state's capital budget, down 1,600 jobs, 5%. Construction, obviously tied to both oil and gas and also state capital budget, down 8.5%. State government, down 1,300 jobs, 5%. And then the couple of pieces of our economy that grew in 2016. Healthcare, 900 jobs. Healthcare has been growing stronger than average for a long, long time, and that continued, although that's a little bit reduced growth from previous years. Federal government, that's interesting because for quite a few years it was flat to down, so a little bit of growth there. State government's interesting because it is stickier, as you probably know better than I do, both up and down. So a loss of 5% is significant. Kind of expanding the perspective a little bit, zooming out, in other words, this is essentially our modern history in job growth. We're going to look at a few different macroeconomic indicators. It's partly because I'm biased, because jobs are really produced, and that's the Department of Labor. But it really is probably the most relevant indicator, both nationally and in Alaska. Well, and you could quibble about that with gross domestic product, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But this is kind of the history of our economy most broadly. And one of the things you see here is that we earned our reputation as a boom and bust state in the 70s and 80s. We absolutely were. Post-pipeline completion job loss, that wasn't a particularly dark period in our economy. It was just the completion of a massive project. So the late 70s, and we'll talk more about this with a different slide, that was more kind of a almost like the end of World War II for the nation. There was job loss because industrial things scaled down, but it didn't feel dark and somber. The 80s, very much different. There was very strong growth heading into the recession, very traumatic economic period for the state, and you see that the range of declines there are still well above what we're either seeing or forecasting in the current period. But to the boom and bust point, if you take Alaska from 1991 forward, we are almost the model of stability by this metric. As you know, there were lots of things happening during that period, including oil price going up and down, concerns about savings being depleted, but the savings and some other things, one, us being a young economy, kept us steadily producing jobs for 20-plus years. So it's kind of an interesting contrast. Boom and bust, sure, 70s, 80s, much less so in the next 20-something years. So looking at 2017 and what we believe would happen, we do, as I kind of alluded to at the beginning, we do less of this, and we do less of this forward-looking, somewhat speculative data production or analytical production, and a little bit more what is happening. But we do this, and we think it's important, and the main task is not to peg the number right, but to try to point to the things that are driving the growth or the lack of growth. So in this case, looking at the details, we are forecasting more job loss in oil and gas, but a reduced rate than 2016. So we won't see another 20% hit, we don't believe, in oil and gas jobs. Similarly, reduced losses in construction, professional and business services. That first wave has hit, and we believe that the loss, and we see it in the data, early signs, that the losses are getting smaller. But what we see is kind of the second wave effect, the downstream effects. Consumers spending less, so less money being spent in restaurants, in stores, banks, a little less business. State government, to a large degree, is a downstream effect. If there's less money to spend, then it doesn't get spent, and that creates some downstream effects. Healthcare still forecasted to grow, but not by much. And that one's interesting. When we first released this forecast, somebody talked about it being a bright spot. Maybe it was us. Maybe it was the reporter. I'm not sure. But in one of the comments, I'm a little bit addicted to comments, and I probably should grow up and stop looking at them. But somebody said, well, they made a point. That's not a bright spot, and that's an interesting point because healthcare is complicated, as you well know. So, but economically, the fact that it's growing means more jobs and more payroll dollars circulating through the economy. Whatever else it means, it means that. So, this idea of a recession, we wrote this article about a year ago because we and others were getting this question: is Alaska in a recession? And we got a little bit tired of saying, well, what do you mean by recession? Because there is no specific definition at the state level. Nationally, there's a group, National Bureau of Economic Research, who's kind of become the accepted arbiter of recessions. They date the beginning and the end. But the specifics really aren't as important as the concept that it means a significant decline in economic activity that spreads across the economy. So there have been times when the fishing industry has struggled. It's not necessarily a recession, oil industry, those kinds of things. But when it spreads across the economy broadly, and there are subjective decisions to be made about that, but that's a recession. And there are different ways to look at that. We ended up saying three consecutive quarters of job loss, over-the-year job loss. So if first quarter of 2015 were below a year ago, plus second quarter, plus third quarter, something more than seasonal is happening. That's fundamental and deep enough. Looking quickly just at national recessions, over this 1970s to the current period, there have been six, And what the blue line is job numbers. Job numbers aren't the only thing that are considered. In fact, gross domestic product probably weighs more heavily in this National Bureau of Economic Research Group's determinations of starting and finishing. But job losses are always one of the things that occur in a recession. And I'll just point out that the U.S. Great Recession of this modern period was easily the steepest. And it was also the longest, about 19 months. And what you see there, the downturn in the blue line at the end of the 2000s period, that was about 4.5% job loss. So about twice what we're seeing now for the U.S. And remember, we lost less than 0.5%. So we didn't have the same history.
Dan, I apologize for having to step out for a moment, but I also did want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Sullivan Leonard, and thank you for joining us.
So moving to Alaska, over that same period, and this goes back to that point about boom and bust, we've had, by our definition, that three quarters, and there's nobody, we can talk about this, the details, and it's probably only interesting to you know, nerds like me, but three recessions, three significant extended downturns. The 70s period, which I mentioned, it wasn't particularly dark. The 80s period, which absolutely was. And then this period in 2009, which was just barely three. And we'll talk about the length of these periods in a slide in a minute. But half as many as the U.S. So we grew right through an early 90s recession. We grew right through an early 2000s recession. The U.S. had two recessions in the early 80s. We were booming. And the early 80s is interesting. I'll just make one quick point. Sometimes people say Alaska's counter-cyclical to the U.S. And like a lot of things, there's some truth to that, but it's too quick. It's too glib. At times, we have grown when the U.S. hasn't, and the 80s is the best example of that. And oil is the best explainer of that. High oil prices are absolutely good for Alaska's economy. High oil prices are a minor drag for the U.S. economy, but not big enough to create true counter-cyclicality. So if you hear that, you just know there's a little more to it. And so let's moving on. A couple of years ago, I was a little bit concerned that people didn't see that this was going to happen. I remember having a conversation with somebody, and they said, "Well, it looks like everything's fine by the data, whether it was unemployment insurance claims or something else." And I said, "Everybody in this room, all the economists in my shop, know that a recession is coming. You don't make these kinds of extractions from an economy without having this downstream effect." And so there's that awareness now, quite clearly, I think, in the Alaska, the conversations that are happening. There's an awareness that we're in a recession. Now the question becomes, what is a recession? How long does it last? Some of those questions, you dissect them. What can we learn from history? So one question here is, how long do they last? So eight quarters in the 70s, eight consecutive quarters where we were below year-ago levels for jobs. And then in the 80s, nine quarters, and then in this most recent period, just barely three quarters. Well, by this definition that we semi-invented or defined, we started losing jobs in the fourth quarter of 2015. So that means we're six quarters in to job loss. So as historians know, history doesn't exactly repeat itself, but there are important lessons. So if we were to follow this basic pattern, sometime in 2018, we would probably see resumed job growth. No guarantee that we will, but that's relevant. And then the depth is another question. How, you know, I talked about 2% and 2.3%, looking at history, and also 7,000 jobs, 8,000 jobs in that range, much, much deeper losses in the 70s period, also deeper losses in the 80s, and remember too that our economy was smaller then. So this is a numerical change. On a percent change, it would be even bigger. But that's roughly what our experience with recessions show in terms of depth of losses. Another question that we got a lot, and it's a very relevant, good question, is how are things different than the 80s? People who are here in the 80s said, oh, I know what's going to happen. I know how this goes. My housing value collapses, foreclosures pick up, people leave the state. Those things did happen. But again, it's a little too, you don't want to draw the wrong lessons or oversimplify and not look at the differences. So we looked at that in the last year. What were the drivers in the 80s recession? How are we different this time? And I'll just mention a few. Our population is older and has been here longer. And that's very significant because the deeper your roots go, the less likely you are to get out of Dodge when things go bad. In the 80s, 24% of people were in their 20s. One out of four people that you met on the street were in their 20s. That's a lot of 20-year-olds. Now we're down below 15%. And the other side of that is we had a big in-migration surge in both the 70s to build the pipeline and all the activity, and in the 80s. So we had a lot of people who hadn't been here very long. And with a boom and bust mentality, a lot of those people did leave when the economy turned south. So that's an important difference. Another difference is that our pre-recession economy, we were growing really strongly in the early 80s. We haven't been. And housing prices haven't been going up fast the way they were in the U.S. before the U.S. recession. So we don't have an overheated economy by any stretch. We also have significantly larger savings now than we did then. That gives us a cushion. A difference on the other side is that oil production is on a clear declining trend. It has been since the late 80s. And in 86, 87, it hadn't yet peaked. So we had a whole lot of oil still to come. There was probably good awareness by economists at the time that this will turn around. Oil prices, you know better than I do, who knows what's going to happen to them. But I doubt anybody expected them to stay at single-digit levels. How are we the same? One of the things we concluded in this article is that this won't surprise anybody. A lot of times economists do that. And we see this in the comments, too. It always gives me a chuckle. They say, well, yeah, you know, people, we're confirming what intuition has already told you. But there's value in that, I believe. But this point is worth making, that we're still very dependent on oil and gas and very dependent on the federal government. We have a fascinating economy and a lot that we offer to the world marketplace, but these two things are very large in Alaska's economy. If something happens to either of these, we will feel it in a way that really I can't think of another state that would be as dependent on a few things. So moving to population and how it relates to jobs, we have an impressive demographic group that studies this, and because of some special tools, including the permanent fund dividend, we have quite high quality data and the ability to look at things that some other states don't. One of the things I wanted to point out here is that you see that the blue line population doesn't go up as much in the 70s or down as much after things end. And then also that population tends to lag. The losses in both the 70s and the 80s came after the job losses. So people don't, your job doesn't go away and you don't move right away. And we saw this with some studies of the pulp mills when they closed in Southeast. People try to hang on. People try to stay. Some of them do. And that's why the blue lines don't go down as far as the employment lines. Then we get to this modern period, the 90s forward, and the relationship gets less, as it often does when the numbers don't move a lot, the relationships are harder to discern. The 2009 numbers are interesting because we tend to have more gains from migration as our economy is stronger than the U.S. Alaska, if Alaska's economy is doing well and the U.S. isn't, we'll get gains from migration. If the reverse is true, we'll get losses. So even though we lost jobs in 2009, we gained people because fewer people were, hey, I'm going to go to Seattle and get a job. There weren't a lot of jobs, and people were, to some degree, coming to Alaska. One of the things we'll talk more about is that there have not yet been significant population losses. This takes us through 2016, but if that relationship holds true, that job loss tends to become population loss, that may be still to come, some population loss. So this is a press release. We just released the 2016 estimates last week, and the basic story is that we did lose some population to migration, about 4,600 people, but we had enough natural increase, so that's births minus deaths, to compensate for that. And we added 2,600 people in 2016. It's about a third of a percent. Matsu had the most growth, about 2,600 people, and Juneau had a loss of about 400. All of those numbers are fairly small, so the story with population is, through 2016, quite stable, with some important things to watch, this one being really at the top of that list. So this is just migration, and this is net migration. We have especially large migration flows for a state. We have about 50,000 people who move to Alaska, and about in the range of 45 to 50 who move out every year. Biggest migration flow of any state, not by a large margin, but some of that makes sense. We have a seasonal economy, we have difficult weather, and we have projects that come and go. But net migration says something about what's happening. In terms of desirability or statements on the economy, whether it's good to be here or whether opportunities are better elsewhere. And what you see in the current period is 4 years in a row of net losses to migration, not large losses, and not nearly as large as we saw, the most relevant period being really the 80s. There hasn't yet been a broad decision, I'm out of here. You know, again, to the comments, people, the last one out, turn off the lights, that kind of stuff. That's so far, just, it's not the story yet. But it's definitely worth watching, and we will, and we'll try to understand it. And we're going to look a little bit at the age of people coming and going in a minute. That's this slide. And this is one of the things that having the permanent fund dividend lets us do. Other states, they don't have as good of data on the age of their population. And this is the average number of people who have come and gone, the net, from the 2010 to 2015 time period. And what this, you could kind of imagine being a marketer. These are the people who want to be here and by age, and the people who want to be somewhere else by age. I'll point out a few things, the group, the only group over this last 5 year period that we're consistently gaining is 20-year-olds. That's there are good things about that, having young people want to be in Alaska. We have things to offer. Historically, this has been true for a long time, and in the decade before this, we also had gains of young children, and the gains extended farther, clear into the early 40s. Consistently, we got more 20 and 30 and early 40-year-olds than we gave. That's a nice thing to have in an economy, that the young families, the working age people. What you've seen happen in this most recent period is kind of a shift. And then the other side of that, we have always lost more than we've gained once you get to your 50s and you get cold and want to live in Arizona or Nevada or Florida. That's a consistent pattern that doesn't change. The shape moves a little bit. But knowing that, well, and one more thing I'll point out, we also have consistently lost population net as people go away to college. So we are a net exporter of college age kids. If you looked at this data from Massachusetts, you'd see something quite different. They're a net importer. North Carolina, that might be true. New York, it might be true. Just much more university capacity than we have. Another thing that I resist is when we talk about a brain drain. It's another thing. It's a little too easy to say, because if they go away and come back, or if we're getting plenty of people in their early 20s, is that a brain drain? Brain drain to me means we're losing these young early career people, and it's more complicated than that. We're getting lots of 20-year-olds. So this the point of this big population picture is to show that population doesn't change. It's a big, slow-moving battleship. It doesn't change fast. It does change. And when we graph the history of this same 1970 to the current period, you see that even when we lost, the losses are fairly short-term and fairly mild. So in the 80s, for example, when you bring in natural increase, the worst single year loss was 15,000 people. There are people speculating that we're going to lose 100,000 people now. Maybe, but that would be very, very outside the, I mean, a factor of 7 times more than we have ever lost, including that deep 80s recession. So the idea of losing huge numbers, it would be new for us. And it could happen, but we don't believe that it will happen. So moving to a different indicator, this is Alaska personal income. And this is something that we sometimes have to remind ourselves, because we produce data on wages and wage and salary employment wages only, so not self-employment income. There are other pieces of income besides what people, the paychecks they take home, including self-employment income, although the largest slice earnings is mostly wage and salary. So when people talk about entrepreneurial things, that's very good and important, but it's a fairly thin slice. Most of the income that Alaskans earn in this large 67% earnings slice comes from a paycheck. The other pieces, dividends, interest, and rent, essentially what you'd think it means. And transfer receipts are interesting. That means, and this is the Bureau of Economic Analysis that produces this data. So the more detailed your questions are on this, the less likely I am to answer it, unlike the other data that we produce. It's a complicated job to track all this income. But transfer receipts are money that people get for which they have done no work. And Alaska, everywhere, that's Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, unemployment insurance. That doesn't mean unemployment insurance and a lot of others. That doesn't mean they haven't qualified or any of those things. But they didn't do work to get that specifically. Unlike earnings, obviously, and unlike dividends, interest, and rent. But the PFD is in that group as a transfer receipt. And this, interestingly, is about the same as the U.S. mix. We have fewer older people, fewer seniors, so there's less Medicare transfer receipts occurring. But we have, because of the PFD, that additional slice that is occurring that makes us brings us back about to the national average. So here, we won't spend a lot of time on this one. This is trends in personal income from 2010 to the current period. We've zoomed in a lot. If you notice the scale, we start at $30 billion and go to $44 billion. So if we showed the full thing, you'd see basically an upward trend. This is valuable partly for what it says about there's no big sign of trouble here yet with personal income. And that's important because if we look at gross domestic product, this next graph, we see a very large decline in the value of our goods and services. That's gross domestic product attempts to value everything that's produced here. It's good to look at this with personal income, I think, because not all of this directly affects Alaskans. A lot of if multinational companies make a lot more money, that doesn't necessarily affect Alaskans. Long term, it's very important to keep an eye on the value of what we produce. And if it's consistently declining, that's going to have some effects other places. But this decline of $62 billion to $50 billion over the 2012 to 2016 period, 20%, that's large. And that you wouldn't say that our economy has shrunk that much. The value of our goods and services have, but that's and this tends to be volatile specifically because of oil, as you can imagine. In 2012, oil, the mining category, was about a third of our total GDP. And back to that point of oil being something we depend on a lot, a third of it. I'm certain you couldn't find a state. North Dakota would be the only possible, except maybe Wyoming, that would have such dependence on a single piece of their GDP. And so just takeaways, and I'd be glad to answer as many questions as we have time for. Alaska's in the midst of moderate job loss. There's no question about that. There's enough data in. And when I say moderate, I don't want to understate what's happening. That's on a scale of, you know, mild, moderate, severe. We're moderate. We're not severe, and it's definitely more than mild. Our population through 2016 remains relatively stable. Our personal income has dipped, but not dramatically. But the value of what we've produced here has dropped significantly. I didn't mention this, but at the very end of that GDP graph, you see an uptick. And that corresponds roughly with the modest increase in oil prices. And I don't know if any of you noticed, but I said on my first slide something about five metrics, and I don't know if any of you counted, but I've talked about four. Well, the other one I'll just mention that I originally planned on talking about was housing. We do some work with AHFC on housing, and that's important, and people are interested in housing, and they should be, because we all, whether we rent or buy or own, we have housing. There is no sign yet of major trouble in the housing market. In the 80s, for example, we had 2,000 foreclosures a quarter at the peak. In the most recent period, we have about 200. So one-tenth as many foreclosures. There's nothing like what was happening in the 80s on the housing market yet. Doesn't mean houses aren't staying on the market longer, prices aren't increasing. But housing is another one that really deserves some attention, because that affects everybody. But there aren't major signs of weakness there. And with that, I will finish and got to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robinson. I appreciate that we have some time left, plenty of time for questions. So I'm actually going to start, which is not my usual tendency. I usually wait and go last, but I didn't write my questions down, so I'm figuring if I can remember them. I read the report that the slides were generated from, which is the trends, the economic trends. We certainly appreciate what the department does, and you had mentioned that our data is quite good. On the way down here, we've been talking to economists about coming before the committee, and certainly the department's data is like the gold standard. So I want to give a kudos to the commissioner and to you for the work. It's just so important as legislators that we make decisions from a standpoint of accurate data. So I just want to throw you that. But one thing stuck out to me when you mentioned the slide on trends in personal income. So the report had said that Alaskans have less disposable income than they have had. And so to me that was a red flag. And, we all know we're in a recession, but I read that. And then when you had mentioned, you had said, there's no big sign of trouble here. So my question has to do with kind of how you approach the data. For example, in my neighborhood, there's homes for sale on my street all the time, and that's more than I've seen in the last several years. You just keep seeing homes for sale. And you said, that the housing market, we've seen no sign yet of major trouble. So can you sort of bridge that gap between trends and major trouble and then what we're seeing, which is when it's your family, your neighbor, or you who have to put your house up for sale, or your child that you fear won't come back from college, how do you explain that? And are you just an optimist, or and are we pessimists, or how do you bridge that?
Yeah, Chuck. So that's a good question. A couple of points. One, this personal income measure is a little bit like a Christmas tree, as I touched on, in terms of it includes transfer payments. So it includes if somebody loses their job and is collecting unemployment insurance benefits, that's captured. If they go on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. So this personal income is the broadest possible measure of income. If we looked specifically at wages, we would see losses, and wages are part of this. In our we have good wage data through second quarter of 2016, and we do see a distinct, and I touched on it when I talked about the oil and gas job loss. Wages have declined, and that's part of what explains the the projected losses in retail trade and in banking and some of those other things. The closest thing there is to trouble with housing is really that activity, lending activity, has gone down. Houses for sale, it's an interesting point, because when I was looking fast, I remember I saw signs everywhere, and I thought that meant something. It's a little bit what we're programmed to see, because in the data, there's not yet a large increase in people leaving, as we touched on, or houses on the market. The houses are staying on the market a little bit longer, and we're in the early days, really, and our data lags. So it's possible that even now, what you're seeing reflects something that we'll see down the road in the data. But to the very broad point, there's nothing happening that feels free fall. The 80s would have been a little different. Things happen fast. This we've seen coming. Partly because of the budget and partly because of oil prices. But this is happening fairly slowly. We are still on the downward. We're still heading into something. So the depth of that recession, we don't know yet, but it's slow and it's fairly measured so far.
Thank you. Also, on the sources of Alaska personal income chart, which shows the 60% coming from earnings, and you had mentioned that it's coming directly from a paycheck. So, in the past few years, this committee has worked very hard on promoting entrepreneurship and innovation and new business growth. And so I wanted you to comment on the value of entrepreneurs, because what this tells me is that either we're not doing a good enough job helping entrepreneurs, or, you know, our economy is simply the business owners are providing paychecks, and we have to be very careful as we look at our options about how we are going to impact the people who are responsible for, you know, meeting the payroll.
Right.
I mean, I'm very cognizant, and I mentioned to you before the committee started, was, you know, for me and I, hopefully the committee and all of us, is that we look at what impact on the economy our decisions will have, not just a particular slice, which might be the state government. But we have to look at the entire picture, how it affects the entire picture. So if you don't mind just commenting on, are we not doing a good enough job with entrepreneurs and small business growth, or is this just what we can expect?
Chair Costello, that's a good question, and one clarifying point. This earnings includes both wage and salary and self-employment income. And so the entrepreneurial activity that's happening, the self-employment, and that includes dentist partnerships, accounting partnerships. They're not getting a wage and salary. They own a business, and they're getting a share of that. So that is included, and it's about the wage and salary piece is about $28 billion of that $41.5 billion. The entrepreneurial, and depending on how you define that, is about $3.5 billion. So to give you some sense of scale, it is there. To the second point of whether we're doing a good enough job, I don't know nearly enough to try to answer that question. But I will say one of the reasons entrepreneurial activity is important is it becomes wage and salary employment. Bill Gates, you know, he's an entrepreneur, right? But at some point, he becomes an employer of thousands of wage and salary employees. So it's an incubation. I've never looked at entrepreneurial promotion as a waste of time or energy, because it becomes these other things.
Thank you very much. And again, I wanted to mention for those listening in, if there are questions and you want to send them to our Facebook, we have the committee has a Facebook page, and we look forward to that. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dan, for your presentation. Very informative. I'm sorry, I missed your background. Are you an economist or a mathematician?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, I'm an economist. I was a lawyer for a while. Don't hold that against me. But I think what we do is more, we are more data producers than really academic economists.
Okay, so I think the questions I have will be fair enough questions. So you've heard our economy is a three-legged stool.
Right.
You got the oil, you got the federal spend, and then you got state and everything else. And obviously, based on your presentation here, two of those three legs are not too sturdy. So definitely our stool's a little wobbly right now. But the bright spot was the federal jobs, and you said they were up, I believe, 300. What type of jobs are those?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, the reason for the growth is broad-based. It's more that the declines in basically the Forest Service, for years it was ramping down and moving offices out of state and things like that. So it's more that the declines have stopped, and then normal population-based progression is there. But more importantly, it's not so much the federal jobs, it's the federal money to Alaska. If you track federal money to states, for years, and the data, partly because of federal budget cuts, has gotten harder to track, but we are at or near the top of money received, federal money, to Alaska. That includes military. And military, if you're in Fairbanks, it's 20% of their population with active duty and dependents. So think broader than just federal jobs. And right now, that leg is fairly strong. Always worth paying attention to with base closures and things like that.
Well, and if I could follow up on that, have you factored in any Trump effect? With President-elect Trump coming in, at least so far, he's done a good job of keeping jobs in America. I heard just today more automakers are canceling their plans to go to Mexico, and they're going to put their plants back in the Detroit, Michigan, and create thousands of jobs, which is all great. We appreciate that. And then, of course, he wants to be tough on immigration. So that would tell me then that there's going to be a high demand for our labor, U.S. labor, which again is a good thing. But is that going to create more migration out of Alaska to now go to Michigan or Arizona, wherever these new jobs are being created?
Yeah, Senator Meyer, through the chair, that's a good question. The answer in terms of whether we factored in is no, and that's because it's way too speculative now. What we'll most likely do is a few years from now look at what has happened and try to tease out some of the causation. But things like migration to and from Alaska are tend to be driven by more powerful forces than the ones you've mentioned so far, and it's still too early to see if international migration, the balance of migration to the country changes significantly. We get a lot of international migration as well in Alaska, so potentially it could have an effect, unlikely to have a really large effect, especially short term.
Okay, and Madam Chair, just one more question.
Senator Meyer.
You mentioned that, and again, I was here in the 80s when we went through the recessions, and you're saying the economy, it's not fair to compare today's recession with the one in the 80s, because back in the 80s, we had a lot more production. In fact, we were still producing close to 2 million barrels back then. But now we're looking at a pipeline that's only a quarter full, maybe 550,000. So would that make our outlook bleaker now, knowing that, boy, we just don't have the production that that we had back in the 80s?
Senator Meyer, and through the chair, it's a semi-complicated answer. I'd say I don't know if I would say bleaker. In fact, I wouldn't say bleaker. I would say our dependence on that piece of our economy will likely shrink. So, and it has already, and the GDP figures show that diversity is an interesting topic. You can't very easily make it happen, but it's happening. It will happen. And basically because of the production decline. And we've seen that pattern since it peaked in production decline. There's obviously a lot of oil and gas resources still in the state, so to suggest that it's going away would be going too far.
But those jobs are being replaced, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Those jobs are being replaced with what? Are we replacing oil jobs that maybe pay good salaries with retail jobs?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, it's it's never quite accurate to say being replaced. Sometimes people in Southeast say we gave up timber jobs in exchange for tourism jobs. It's not what happened. This thing went away and this thing grew. So there was no this for that factor. Our economy is becoming more mature, so that means more service sector jobs, including healthcare, more healthcare jobs. But it's critically important to keep an eye on the drivers, and that's where the GDP data come in, among other places. What are we producing that the world markets want from Alaska? Because that's what creates the other jobs. So to the extent we are replacing an oil and gas job with a retail job, that's short term. The retail job depends on the oil, the mining, the fishing, the tourism, the federal spending on military, those things that bring money into the state that then circulate and create the other jobs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three questions. I think two of them are relatively simple and the other may be a little longer answer. So on the slide that talks about moving to population trends and the growth in, population and compared with employment, what is the impact of out-of-state workers here? Are they factored out? I mean, if the population, the last 20 years is relatively stable as our jobs. Has there been a change, growth, or a reduction in out-of-state workers?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, that's one of the things you see in the 70s is that we had really high employment growth that didn't translate into nearly as high population growth. So that what that says is we had a lot of non-resident workers here. We have a report that we do annually to the legislature on non-resident workers in this state. And the trend in recent period has been slightly up. That's a complicated thing to track, and the way we do it is with permanent fund dividend eligibility, which is a strict definition of residency, so there's some important caveats there. But in recent history, the trend has been slightly up in the percentage of workers in Alaska who've worked here at any point in the year who are non-residents.
Thank you. And if I might, Madam Chair, a brief discussion about the brain drain and that we're gaining people in their 20s. For families, the question is, are these new people coming in for an Alaskan adventure, or are our own children growing into the 20s and staying here, or coming back from education out of state?
All right, Senator Gardner, through the chair, that I agree. It's an important question. We did an article on that in Trends a while ago called we compared homegrown people in their 25 to 29, that bracket, compared to the ones who were raised here, to compare how they were, what jobs they were working, how much they were making, those kinds of things. And it's a mix of new people. Some people go away to college and stay down south. Some people come back, and then we attract some. So it's a mix.
Thank you. And then my last question is about the slide into a recession, and this may be a little bit outside of your data bailiwick, but do you think that timely and decisive action by the legislature on a fiscal plan with stability and balance could have changed the trajectory?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, could have, it's hard to say. One of the things we are wrestling, I think, unsuccessfully with, I think Musin from ICER and Jonathan from Northern Economics might talk a little bit more about this, but the cost of uncertainty. But there is no question that uncertainty has an economic cost, because it encourages inaction. If you're considering buying a house, if you're considering moving to a place, if you're considering investing in something, then uncertainty, and that's part of what's at the heart of what a recession means. It's a lack of confidence in an economy. So while there are big problems still being wrestled with, it's hard to see the growth resuming, normalcy resuming. And that was true of the U.S. economy during the housing crisis. While things are unsettled, businesses don't invest, people don't leave their jobs who might otherwise to seek a better job. So very much uncertainty is part of the equation. Getting precise about the degree is you know, an economist's headache, and really it can never be quantified with any precision.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Gardner, for your question. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Ms. Robbins. That's fascinating things to think about. Just a couple of thoughts I have. I appreciate any reflection you have. One is on the urban-rural issues, and secondly is on the permanent fund dividend. Urban-rural, it seems to me that everything you say applies to urban Alaska. I'm just not so sure if it all applies to rural Alaska. And by that, I mean not only the village life, but also the more moderate-sized communities that I represent. And second thing, the permanent fund dividend, we're messing around with the PFD, and what is the impact of that? You know, it seems to me in Anchorage, I mean, it may be entirely false, but it seems to me the PFD is important but not really crucial in Anchorage. In my communities, important, maybe a little more crucial, but in village communities, absolutely crucial, absolutely important. So any reflection on those two issues?
Sure. Senator Stevens, through the chair, for the urban-rural question, it's really an important one, and that's another thing we need to remind ourselves often, that when we talk about Alaska's macroeconomic indicators, we are really talking, the things that drive that are Anchorage, Matsu, Juneau, Fairbanks, the big areas. But I'll give you one example for unemployment rates. Rural Alaska has some of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. And as you're probably familiar, to be defined as unemployed, you have to be actively seeking work. So if you quantified the percent of people working, then we get really extreme in terms of rural Alaska, some economic struggles in parts of the state. Another point to your district, there are parts of the state that really are single driver economic areas, whether it's fishing in far western Alaska or tourism, Skagway and Denali. They have one thing that drives their local economy. So those things don't tend to be nearly large enough, especially locally, to move these big numbers. So you're absolutely right to remind us that we need to keep in mind that the state macro indicators don't tell the story of everywhere in Alaska. To the permanent fund dividend point, I pulled this slide back up because if you're talking, and we see when Governor Palin had the resource, the extra thing, that was large enough. When you start talking about 700,000 people and $3,000 per person, that's a couple of billion dollars. So that moves these macro indicators. It's there for sure, and it's an important part of our economy. Back to the rural-urban piece, and to this slide, if you built a pie chart for this for parts of rural Alaska, the transfer receipts would be far larger percentage of the total. So it depends on the area. The lower income you are, the larger a factor PFT is on you and on your local economy.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question, Senator Stevens. It almost seems like we need, you know, multiple pie charts to describe Alaska, and it's hard to characterize in just one, but right. We appreciate knowing the overall makeup. Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'll just mention, I lived in the rural Alaska in the 80s, and I did feel like we were pretty protected from it. I lived in Bethel and Fort Yukon at the time. And I want to make a comment, Madam Chair, and then I have a couple of questions. And one of them is piggybacking on Senator Meyer's comments and question about manufacturing picking up and perhaps a Trump impact. And I know it's an unknown factor, but we could also just keep in the back of our minds, he's talking about a huge push for transportation infrastructure. And so that may help us out, and I will make a comment that I think it's important that we show an appetite for transportation infrastructure as a very important, too, for economic development, which, as Madam Chair mentioned, is a passion of mine. I have just a basic quick question and then one that you might expound on a little bit more, and that is, as your job's collecting data, do you feed that to the federal government for the overall U.S. Data that they put out? And then you mentioned a national organization that pinpoints the start and end dates of recessions, and have they pinpointed a start date for us?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, in answer to your first question, Oh, now I'm going to have to ask you to remind me your first question. I have an answer, but
whether you feed your data to how they get their data at the federal level.
Yes, in fact, the data production system is a federal state cooperative system. So the unemployment rates, job numbers, we work with the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they fund us to generate that data. Some data that we produce here is state-specific, if it's based on the permanent fund dividend, resident employment worker report. That's a state-specific data production. So yes, and our demographics population people work closely with the census. As you know, a whole lot of money gets distributed from the census, so we work closely with them to make sure they count us correctly and accurately. Mm-hmm. That's a tough thing for places where people are living on boats or in group quarters. And so Alaska has, as it often does, some special challenges. But yeah, it's a close relationship, state and federal. To your second question, the National Bureau of Economic Research does not date state recessions. It's just national recessions. And I actually had an interesting conversation last week with some people from the Pew Research Center. They were interested in they'd seen our article, I think, in what states do, if anything, to try to date recessions or define them. And really, very few people do. A California colleague said there's no such thing as a state recession. And California can say that because they're one-ninth of the U.S., and a U.S. recession tends to be a California recession. But by that broader definition of economic distress that spread widely, that's what we're seeing now. And like I said, we've dated that at beginning the fourth quarter of 2015. So we're fairly deep into the measurement period.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a second question.
Please.
On the second slide, we talked about, entitled in industry details, it talked about 6,800 jobs statewide in 2016. And I picked up on the state government down 1,300 jobs, but yet I had understand that when a lot of those job losses are positions or people retiring or moving away, and that there were really only maybe less than 100 people that would still be working in their positions that are no longer. So we're kind of talking about people versus positions there. And so I'm wondering whether you've teased that out, and for any of the other industries there in the private sector, are those literally people who have lost their jobs? I mean, are we comparing apples to apples here, or apples to oranges when it comes to state government?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, that's an important question, and I cringe a little bit anytime I hear people talking about positions economically. What we're talking about here are people in a month who actually receive a paycheck. So whether their position, their PCN in state speak, has gone away or not, if they're receiving a check, they get a mark, there's a tally. If they're not, whether it's because somebody's retired and isn't replaced, or a division doesn't have budget money for whatever reason, it's a monthly average for the year of people receiving checks, and we convert that, we call it jobs. But economically, these are jobs. There are that many fewer jobs in 2016 in state government, averaged over the 12 months, than there were in the year before.
And I have one final question.
Certainly, Senator Hughes.
My understanding is the healthiest thing for the economy is for new dollars coming into the state. Do you do anything to look at whether we're just stirring around the dollars in the state or whether new dollars are coming in? And do you have any data on that?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, there are only approximations to do that for anybody. But I was getting that a little bit when I talked about basic sectors. So you can, and during the U.S. recession, the Stimulus Act, well, Exxon Valdez brought a whole lot of new money into the state that then circulated and did the pipeline construction. So we try to keep it part of the conversation. Quantifying it's tough. And you're absolutely right that what brings money into the state is probably of paramount importance. Secondarily, your ability to circulate that money well and broadly is important. So we had a lot of job growth in the 90s as our retail sector, healthcare sector, all those secondary sectors kind of grew up. So we lost less money. There were fewer trips to Seattle to see a neurologist or something else. That was the money circulating more better. We were losing less leakage. So both of those things are important, but we agree, and I think most economists would, that the basic sector deserves special attention.
Can I have a follow-up comment?
Senator Hughes?
You alluded, as far as health care, that's a pretty complex thing, and I think that's one of the reasons why tourism seems to be a true bright spot, because it is bringing those new monies into the state. Health care is growing, but it's taking a lot more monies out of our pockets to create all those new jobs, and that seems to be stirring it within the state, which doesn't seem quite as healthy to me. Thank you.
So it looks like we have, I know I have further questions, and so does Senator Meyer and Senator Gardner. So with that, Senator Gardner.
I just have a quick request for you and for other presenters, where possible, to number the pages, because it makes it easier for us to refer back to them for questions.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it seems like, I'll just follow up on Senator Hughes's comment about the tourism, and I've heard as well as that tourism is a bright spot, and it's going to, help the state economy. But then when I stop and think, what does the state get from tourism? We get very little. Now, I know it does help the local communities and it creates jobs there, but from the state you get maybe the cruise ship head tax, and if they smoke or drink, you get a little tax off of that, and they fish, you get something off of that, but and I guess a car rental a little bit, but very little actual new money coming into the state coffers. Is that correct,
Senator Meyer, through the chair? I don't know for sure, because we don't, the state to us really means to the state's economy. I think that's one of the things that Alaska wrestles with, is without income tax, without sales tax, things can happen in the state that don't create any income, any revenue for the state to then grow. So it's an important question, but it's for us, our focus would be more on the wages, the job, and then when we're trying to forecast what's happening with those metrics. So, for example, we've gone back over 1 million cruise ship passengers, and that does seem to be growing. So that creates a certain number of retail jobs in the areas that get that business.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat familiar with that, and I'll certainly get that data to the committee, and we are having someone presenting on the tourism industry, so we can ask that question. But my recollection is that the industry itself brings in $129 million through local and state revenue, and also that the return on investment in that industry is phenomenal. For every dollar the state invests in marketing, we get a $35 return. And so I do think it's one of those, I think the tourism industry is one of the unsung heroes of the state's economy, and certainly it taps into what you had said about young people moving here because of the quality of life. And when we market, we market the state, we're competing for those travel dollars with Hawaii, who I think spends $48 million on their marketing. It's interesting that you mentioned that, and we'll certainly have, Senator Meyer, we'll have people before us that can drill down into those numbers, but I couldn't have that comment go without replying in defense.
Can I continue then?
I think you can, yeah.
I didn't mean any harm to tourism. Believe me, I love tourism. But Senator Gardner had mentioned, too, out-of-state workers, and I think a lot of the tourism jobs, though, are seasonal, and several of them are out-of-state workers, as well as the fishing industry. But I think out-of-state jobs are still less than 20% of our total jobs in the state of Alaska.
About 20%.
Okay. Because I've heard the argument that, boy, if we had an income tax, we could get this money from these out-of-state workers, but I don't know that there's a whole lot of money to get there, because, first of all, these aren't the highest-paying jobs. There's certainly some oil jobs that are outside that we could grab. But you're actually penalizing 80% of the Alaska workforce if you do an income tax, and I guess I would just like your opinion on if I believe that the private sector is pretty weak right now, and I think you would agree with all the job losses. And then those that have been able to still keep their jobs probably haven't had a raise in 2 or 3 years. So now if we take more money away from them via an income tax or the PFD reduction, doesn't that hurt the economy even more? I guess I'm a sales tax guy because I think that's one thing that you can kind of avoid because, you know, it's consumption. Some things you have to buy, of course, but not everything.
Senator Meyer, through the chair, the consequence of any extraction of funding from the economy depends on a lot of things, the income levels of the people getting it. And I think Musin, especially from ICER, will talk more about that. But anything that takes money out of an economy will have an effect. One thing to keep in mind is the extent to which the money is re-spent. So unemployment insurance, for example, it tends to mostly get spent. If you lose your job and you get a percentage of what you would have earned, you're paying a mortgage and you're buying groceries and those kinds of things. On the other hand, if you take income from an especially high earner or tax somebody who has a lot of wealth, that gets re-spent in smaller percentages. So that's one of the many things that economic models try to get at, the multiplier of the extraction of money from the economy.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate the question about the income taxes. That was also something I just wanted to touch on. As you know, we in the past have looked at a variety of options to address our fiscal challenges, and both in our conversations and in the committee, you touched on the sort of the driving or silent force of confidence or uncertainty that actually, in a sense, defines a recession. It's almost, and we hear it as legislators, people are uncertain. They're uncertain about the future, about our economic future. And my question is, what impact does an income tax have on consumer confidence, and can you measure that?
Chair Costello, I don't know, and I suspect you can't measure it precisely. The confidence issue, I mean, the potential of an income tax may have some effect on somebody's thinking about whether to move to Alaska or whether to stay in Alaska if they're here. But I think I'd have a hard time thinking anyone would disagree that the uncertainty related to this big structural challenge of funding state government, a new paradigm, whatever, getting that stable is a far bigger factor in terms of uncertainty than the possibility of a certain type of, especially personal tax.
I think you misunderstood my question. I'm not talking about uncertainty about possible options. I'm talking about taxing Alaskans' income. What impact does that have on an economy? Can we expect our economy to grow if we tax people's income?
Chair Costello, it's an extraction, but if in a really simple world, economists, there's a phrase, ceteris paribus, everything being equal. In a really simple world, if you taxed income and then spent 100% of that income, that's a net neutral effect on an economy. That never happens, of course. There are lots of other things happening. But keep in mind, I think it's useful to keep in mind that is the money being re-spent? Money doesn't disappear, it goes somewhere. So when you whatever kind of tax, it's a transfer from individuals to the government. What the government does with that money matters for an economy, for the macro economy.
And then also on slide, I think it's slide 3, can you share the division between the number of, it's in terms of job loss, how many jobs have been private sector jobs and how many have been public sector jobs?
Chair Costello, the state government through 2016 was the only piece of government, so the other two being federal and local, that lost jobs. So we've got that that loss of 1,300. Overall, the private sector losses, we have that number, but you see these select sectors, the jobs on a percentage basis, the loss there, they're substantially bigger, especially in oil and gas. You see professional business services, the losses are in the same range as government. But overall, the private sector losses in 2016 are almost certainly a little larger than the total government losses.
So they must be, since we lost 6,800 jobs, and you're saying 1,300 were state government, so that would mean the remainder would be the private sector. And I think the economic trends starts out talking about that it was first seen, the recession first hit the private sector the hardest, and then we now are seeing the government jobs lost through budget reductions.
And Chair Costello, the different ways to measure that on a percentage basis, numerically, you're right. If 6,800 are lost and 1,300 are state government, then that means the remaining. Especially when you account for a little bit of job growth in federal government and a tiny bit of job growth in local government. Overall, the number of private sector jobs lost is quite a bit bigger than the number of government job losses.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions from committee members? Senator Hughes.
I don't remember the slide, but it was the one about ages, and you were talking a bit about the 20-somethings. But I have heard some of the senior group talk about the importance they are to the economy. And when I think back, when I first came up to Alaska in the 70s and in the early 80s, it seemed somewhat rare that Grandma and Grandpa also lived in Alaska. Now that's quite common. So it does seem like our seniors do stay around, and I think that you attested to that. But I didn't see that listed as a positive for what we're facing now as compared to what we faced in the 80s. Would you think that is a positive for us? Or
Senator Hughes, to the chair, it's positive or negative. It's going to be a factor. So even though we lose we have a regular net outflow of seniors, we are getting a lot more because there are a lot more in the pipeline. And then the other factor is people have deeper roots here than they used to. Their kids, their grandkids are here now to a greater degree than they used to be. So that their spending, whether it's Social Security, their retirement savings, that's absolutely a net economic benefit. Part of that equation has to be any costs that come with that to the state. Most of those senior benefits come from the federal government. So Florida has an economy that one of its pillars is seniors. It's an economic force, and that's true of Arizona and Nevada a little bit too.
Follow up.
Senator Hughes.
Just to clarify my question, my understanding, what I've heard from senior groups, is that they are stating that it is a benefit. So I guess my question to you, is that accurate? That because you talked about, you know, what they're bringing in as opposed to what they're taking. So is it a net benefit compared to when we didn't have seniors in the 80s?
Yeah, Senator Hughes, through the chair, their income is absolutely a benefit to the state.
All right. With that, I want to. Senator Meyer, final question.
If we have time, Madam Chair.
I'm hoping to adjourn at 10:30.
Okay. And this may not even be your bailiwick. So if so, just say so. But I know one issue that's going to come up this year. I haven't checked with my senator to my left yet, but I'm pretty sure oil tax credits will be an issue. Has anybody evaluated the value of those to the economy, in the sense that the small producer tax credits on the North Slope, for example, have attracted new companies, smaller companies that may or may not have come up here without the tax credits, who are employing Alaskans and who are actually finding oil that will be our future income to the state and future jobs. But on the other hand, they're expensive. As we know, I don't know what we owe now, $600-700 million or more. Has anybody evaluated the I mean, that would be helpful information, I think, to us as to whether or not we continue this program or we get rid of it.
Senator Meyer, through the chair, the limit of our evaluation of that would be identifying job growth or decline and then looking at the companies, whether they're new or not, to see what that says about likely future. But the balancing of whether the cost of the credits outweigh the benefits to the economy is not something we would do, and it would be a pretty complicated. You'd have a hard time getting a specific answer to that question without a whole lot of caveats anywhere. That's a hard question.
Okay, Manager, is somebody attempting that though? Again, I think that would just be helpful for us to have that.
Yeah, Senator Meyer, through the chair, I think that would be a question for the people from ICER and potentially Northern Economics.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will have this afternoon a meeting at 1:30, and we will have with us individuals from ICER and also Northern Economics. So committee members will have a chance to hear their presentations, and then we'll have all of the presenters back at a follow-up meeting for a panel discussion where we will be fielding questions. And so, again, I want to thank you, Mr. Robinson, for coming before the committee, and also Commissioner Dragas, appreciate it. For future hearings in the committee, we have a Facebook page, and I encourage everyone to like that. It's an easy way to get the message out, and we will also welcome questions on that page that we will then forward to our presenters. Yes, Senator Hughes.
The Facebook page, excuse me, would you do a search, what, Alaska Senate
so you
Labor
would search,
and Commerce?
Alaska Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and thank you for that question. Senator Stevens.
Just a comment to wrap up from my standpoint. I really appreciate the presentation, and I think to me one of the great takeaways is the boom and bust we have always assumed. I mean, everyone writes about it, thinks about it, assumes Alaska's in a boom and bust, and you made it very clear that for the last 20 years there's not been a boom and bust. So maybe it's a new age for Alaska. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.